Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, 17th of September, 1999. We are in the fireside room of Koinonia this afternoon. Your presenters' names are Drs. Cliff Hall, Peter Cleaver, and David Cleaver. The session number is 99-2, and the title is Herbal Medicine, Dietary Supplements, continuing the Faith in Medicine in the New Millennium series. Let's listen in.
Medicines. A naturopath is somebody who not only does herbal medicines, but will also do nutrition, counseling, a variety of procedures like hypnotherapy, hypnosis for things. They may also do some of the alternative procedures we talked about yesterday. They also may do something called homeopathy, which is a very specific thing, very specific practice that's been around for quite a while. And homeopathy specifically is a practice that was developed around diluting substances down quite a bit. It's the term like cures like is very important in homeopathy, in that they look at the symptoms a person has and tries to find a substance that causes those same symptoms. So that if somebody has a lot of nausea and vomiting, they look for a substance that might cause nausea and vomiting, but then they dilute it down. And when I'm talking about diluting, just magnitudes of dilution. So that there's hardly any of the substance left in the water. And the theory is that when you dilute it down, the water keeps the memory of the substance in its basic makeup. So that you don't have a lot of toxins, but it still has some of the properties that cure the symptoms. That's about what I know about homeopathy. It's essentially water that you get with a very, very, very small amount of the substance that they think will help the symptoms. There's no real scientific basis to this idea that water keeps memory, and if you think about it, water has to come from somewhere originally, and why doesn't it keep its memory of the lead or the other substances that were in it to begin with before it was purified? So from a scientific point of view, that doesn't make a lot of sense. I'm not saying that there isn't some other reason for that, for what they're talking about, but I think from a scientific point of view, there's very little basis for that idea. Many of the herbal supplements that we're talking about today are starting to be tested and have been tested mainly in Europe. Europe has had a long history, especially in Germany, of using herbal supplements in their mainstream practice and have done quite a few studies, some of dubious background, some probably fairly well documented and controlled. And they have quite a documentation and actually have put these in book forms. We're starting to get some of that in the United States. There's actually a PDR, a physician desk reference, like you have for prescription medications is actually coming out for herbal medications also. Of course, some of that, you gotta always remember with physician desk references, the information there is provided by the manufacturer. So that doesn't necessarily say that just because it's in a book of that form that it's proven or is safe. It's just merely information provided by the manufacturer. As we said yesterday, and Chantal brought this up, many herbal medicines, many of our medicines in conventional medicine have come from plants. At least a quarter of them came directly from herbal sources or plant sources. You may have heard some of the chemotherapy agents for cancer, such as Taxol, is one that comes directly from the Pacific yew tree bark. And there's many more examples like that. So there's kind of a crossing over between some of these alternative medicines into conventional medicine also. I'd like to talk a little bit about what I see is the problems with using herbal medicines. And then we're going to go into which ones have some scientific basis to them for their use and some experience with them that shows that they might have some benefit to people. The main things that I see as wrong with using herbal medicines, especially ones that haven't been scientifically tested or proven, in some cases it may lead people from using an effective conventional medicine. I think this is probably particularly true, and Dad can speak more to this, in cancer treatment, where people will forego chemotherapy or other possibly effective forms of treatment for, say, Laetrile was one that was very big in the past. I don't know if it still is. I think it's kind of died out a little bit. But a very unproven therapy that people got essentially no benefit and may have been harmed by in the past. The second thing that's, I think, probably one of the most important things about herbal medicines that you need to remember is that there's very little regulation of herbal medicines and dietary supplements. There's very little or no standards for their purity or their content or their efficacy. And that's especially true now after a law passed in 1994 that was pushed through by Senator from Utah, Orrin Hatch, where there's a lot of pharmaceutical companies, by the way, in Utah, a lot of dietary supplement companies, where he weakened the regulation quite a bit of herbal medicines and essentially cut the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, out of watching over those specific substances. The products under that law can be sold with no testing for effectiveness, which is very different from what prescription medications have to do. Prescription medication has to go through a lengthy and, quite frankly, very costly procedure for being proven effective and also safe. The drawback to that is it costs a lot of money, and those prescription medicines are more costly because of that. On the other hand, herbal remedies and supplements don't have to go through that. They can be put out on the market without testing to see if they're truly effective. Same can go for safety in a lot of cases. They don't have to be proven safe. The standard for herbal medicines are that the FDA has to prove after it's been on the market that it's harmful. So somebody can actually die from an herbal supplement before the FDA can have it withdrawn from the market. Or it has to prove that it's harming people. And that can be a very difficult thing to do once it's out on the market, because that's not a controlled study area. People are taking it for different reasons, different conditions, different amounts, and it's very hard to prove that that's actually what's causing it. Whereas with a prescription medicine, it's been tested in a well-controlled study atmosphere before it gets out on the market. They can put claims on the labels about what they do. I don't think they can specifically claim that it cures a disease, but it's up to the FDA to prove that their claims are untrue. So the burden of proof really becomes the FDA's, which is very different from prescription medications. So the content of these products can vary greatly. There's nothing that says that, you know, the actual active ingredient in a particular product has to be a certain percentage.
Peter, I'd like to make one point. Just when you're going to buy a medication or drug or a herbal supplement or a dietary supplement, they really fall into three categories as far as the FDA is concerned, as far as marketing goes. Number one of those prescription drugs. Those are controlled drugs that you need a physician's prescription in order to get. You just can't go and get cancer chemotherapy medicine or morphine or Valium or something like that. You just can't go and buy that off the shelf. And those drugs are extremely well controlled and certified. And so when somebody says you have 5 milligrams of Valium or a certain dose of thyroid medicine in a pill, it's very, very close and very accurate to that, has to be. There are then over-the-counter medications, which are also extremely well controlled and have to have FDA approval and certification. The ibuprofen, aspirin, Tylenol, all those kinds of medicines, and as time has gone on, greater numbers. The H2 blockers, the medicines like Tagamet and Zantac.
They were formerly prescription.
And Pepsi, that used to be prescription drugs that the drug companies are now marketing. So that those are well controlled. then there's this whole other gamush of stuff that, you're talking about, which Lord knows what you're getting when you buy it. It may or may not, and I'm sure you're going to get into that, it may or may not have what it says it has on the bottle. And so it really is, again, a buyer's beware kind of market, and that's especially true with a lot of the things that you get in the mail and you're going to send away for it, and from a company that's going to give you something for your prostate health or to help your memory or to prevent blindness or whatever, that has a combination of things, or claims to have a combination of things.
And that's an issue even aside from whether the product, the actual ingredient that they're talking about works, because you may be getting so little of that that even if it did work, it's not enough to really help you. And there are many examples. The percent or content can vary widely. Consumer Reports actually put out some nice information about that. Say with ginseng, where they found that capsules varied from 100 to 648 milligrams, despite claims that they were all the same amount. There was, what was the one that you were showing me this morning? It varied from 0 to 150 milligrams.
It's a hormone that affects the metabolism of hormones in the body and can have profound effects. And it varies, it's
DHEA.
And it's similar to the hormone, the preparation that the home run hitter,
Mark McGuire
used. And it's promoted for increasing strength, preventing aging, and so on. But the studies that they carried out on it showed a variation. Five or six of the products which they got right off the shelf had no content. Some were 150%, and then there were others that had other materials in there that weren't listed.
Impurities . So you don't know what you're getting, basically, a lot of cases. There's been some past examples of, I feel, where regulation would have helped forego a bad outcome. Some of you may have heard about L-tryptophan. It's probably been about 4 years ago, maybe longer than that now. L-tryptophan is basically an amino acid or variant thereof that was used for sleep and sedation in some people. That's at least how it was billed. There was an impurity. It wasn't the L-tryptophan itself, but an impurity that was in the L-tryptophan that caused a condition called eosinophilic myalgia syndrome. Basically, what you need to know is it's a very severe illness, to the point that it killed 36 people. And 1,500 people became severely ill. That was a problem with regulation of an impurity in the substance. Ginseng from China has been found with toxic levels of fungicide in it. Some Chinese medicines have been found to have lead, valium, and steroids, amphetamines in them. Those, whether they're added on purpose because they make you feel good and you'll continue to buy the product, or whether they're just an impurity in it, are things you don't know that you're getting when you start with that. There's a lot of substances that designer drugs these days are popular for various things. I don't know how they get included in natural substances, but somehow people seem to think that some of these drugs are natural. There's one called GBC, which was also called Blue Nitro, and there was claims of building muscle and reducing stress and, of course, improving sexual function. That always gets people to buy it, which affected people's central nervous system severely. There's been at least one or more deaths associated with that and many hospitalizations. Some other herbal medicines that have been associated with deaths, all linked to deaths in the past, include comfrey, chaparral, pennyroyal. These things, some of these have side effects that affect you directly. Some of these may have been impurities in the preparations that caused it. So that's just some of the bad examples in the past of how this lack of regulation has led to some severe problems. Now, kind of setting that aside for now, I want to talk a little bit about some of the medicines that there seems to be some support for in helping certain conditions. The first one I want to talk about is St. John's Wort, and many of you may have heard of that. I think that's probably one of the more commonly known herbal medicines. It's been used in Europe as a first-line therapy for mild depression for many, many years. And I think that there's probably enough evidence and support for that now that I think we can legitimately say that it does help in mild depression. That's what I'm talking about, mild. Not the kind of depression that people get hospitalized for or have debilitating symptoms, but mild mood disorders it can help in. All these medicines, just like any medicine, can have side effects. It can be a diuretic, and otherwise, in other words, it can cause you to urinate some. It can also interact with some of the conventional antidepressants, such as Prozac or Zoloft, to a certain extent, especially if you're taking it in large amounts. But that's the main thing that it's been shown to help with is mild depression. So that's St. John's Wort. The second one is saw palmetto, which is a herb that's been used also for quite a while in Europe for moderate symptoms of benign prostatic hypertrophy. It's METTO, palmetto.
It's this little potted palm-like tree that has saw-like leaves. So they call it saw palmetto.
And it's mainly been shown, including in studies in the United States, to relieve moderate symptoms in men of prostatic hypertrophy. In other words, when the prostate gets enlarged, it cuts off the ability to urinate properly in men. Again, it can cause upset stomach and headaches, although really it has very few other side effects. As far as I understand, a form of hormone that's in it. So it shouldn't be taken in men who, say, have prostate cancer or are taking other hormones that are related to testosterone or that class of hormone. There was a study on a specific Chinese herbal remedy. And again, when we talk about some of these herbal remedies, especially some of the Chinese traditional Chinese remedies, it's a mixture of things. This one was specifically delineated in the study as to be 20 different types of herbs. So they knew what it was, and they could standardize what was in this particular Chinese remedy. And they found that it helped a great deal with irritable bowel syndrome. And this was in a placebo-controlled study. So some of these, this is a mixture of 20 herbal components. They didn't say which ones were helping or what the other ones might have done, but this specific 20 herbs did seem to help with irritable bowel syndrome. Glucosamine, you may have heard of, is another popular one for arthritis. And European studies are limited, but they seem to show some pain relief and increased mobility as far as actually looking at whether it stops the progression of arthritis or actually changes the anatomy of arthritis. I'm not sure it's that clear. But in the studies, at least the symptoms seem to improve. And the NIH is doing a large study right now on that. So they must think that there's at least something there that they are willing to invest in. Capsaicin cream, which is from cayenne pepper, is a cream that we originally was designed to help people with pain in their feet from diabetes and also from shingles pain. And it is the mechanism of how it works is actually known, that it depletes a substance in the nerves that transmits the pain. That's why it burns to begin with, because it's releasing all that chemical. Once it's released, though, it helps to relieve the pain, because it's not that the body isn't sensing the pain. Again, it's not actually doing anything to cure arthritis or diabetic foot pain. It's relieving the symptoms in that case.
Could you give me that name again?
The capsaicin?
Yes.
I don't know if I'm not a very good speller, but I'll try.
It's A-N at the end.
I-A-N.
Like that?
Yeah.
No, it's on the other side.
It's all right. Close.
It used to be a prescription medication called Zostrix. And it's over the counter now. You can buy that in cream form. And that is something that relieves pain and arthritis.
It's kind of fascinating because it really is, it's in the pepper.
Yeah.
It's what burns your tongue and mouth and stomach when you eat the pepper. And it also points out as to why if you continue to eat peppers over a period of time in the high concentration, you become much desensitized to the pain and burning because it depletes the
process. But you got to get through that first stage. Many of the rest of these that I'm going to talk about, well, one, folate is something that's been pretty well proven in pregnant women to prevent some of the birth defects that come on in pregnancy. That one, that's pretty well documented. The rest of these, several of these, aren't quite as well documented, such as zinc lozenges. You may have heard of those. For cold symptoms, there was at least one Cleveland Clinic study that did show limiting cold symptoms, but you have to take it within 24 hours of the start of the cold. So it's rather limited, but it does seem to limit the duration of the symptoms. Ginkgo biloba is one that has been shown in just one study, so it's not very limited studies to possibly slow the progression of Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is a very difficult disease to study, and one study, I'm not necessarily certain if that's going to be stand up in the future, but it is something that has been looked into, at least in one study. Garlic is something that does seem to lower cholesterol.
In regard to ginkgo biloba, there are some side effects that are worth noting. And one is that it has anticoagulant effects. So if you're on Coumadin or aspirin, you could get into trouble.
Yeah. And then, of course, the last one I'll mention, there's many others, but the last one I'll mention is fish oil, which the cardiologists are starting to show does have an effect on cholesterol and heart disease. Cliff can speak a lot more to that than I can, and actually has articles to support that. And that has been pretty well studied in the United States. Of course, I'm a big supporter of just eating fish. As with a lot of these supplements, I think it's always better to try and get them from natural foods that you eat anyway in a balanced diet, if you can, than taking them in a formulation that you're not sure what's in them. So
that's an interesting observation. Probably deserves some additional comment. It kind of reflects on sort of the paradox of natural supplements and in terms of how the pharmaceutical industry has so permeated our thought processes that even the people that are most involved in the natural food supplements and these herbal preparations have adopted the same policies and procedures and marketing techniques of the big drug companies. And examples of that is there have been all kinds of studies done to look at what kinds of habits correlate with various diseases or with health. And it turns out that if you eat lots of spinach and green leafy vegetables, which of course have beta carotene in it, it seems to correlate with a lower incidence of macular degeneration. Instead of everybody going out and just eating lots of green vegetables, it seems to be much easier to go get a little capsule that has beta carotene in it. There's excellent studies that demonstrate if you eat fish, especially cold water sea fish, it started with looking at the Eskimos in Greenland and Iceland. They seem to have a very low incidence of heart disease, and they ate lots and lots of fish. And it turned out that it was the omega-3 fatty acids that are that seem to be the active ingredient in fish that lowers the the incidence of heart disease and hardening of the arteries. So instead of we all go out and have fish a couple times a week, which would be a very reasonable thing to do, it's the American way is, well, why not, instead of bothering with fish and leafy vet, why not just get one little capsule of fish oil? And we just seem to want to take pills and tablets and capsules. And that has really become a cultural thing that... And I'd point that out, just that it is an observation as to how effective I think the drug companies have been and how powerful the pharmaceutical progress has been in this country that has so convinced us, because it's true, one tablet of antibiotics can cure a urinary tract infection just like that, and we all have those experiences with these powerful medicines. Dave, you might want to...
Well, it's just, I would just add that there's evidence that some of the, like omega, I mean, some of the things like beta-carotene, for example, you get the best effect if you get it from the natural source by eating the right kind of vegetables. It doesn't seem to have the same effect if you take it in a pill form.
And actually, the studies using beta-carotene specifically, a lot of recent studies are showing that it really doesn't have benefit in preventing cancer and heart disease and things like that.
Can I ask a question up here?
Mm-hmm.
Based on your comments about eating a balanced, nutritious diet, what we considered a balanced, nutritious diet at this point in time and what was balanced and nutritious 150 years ago has greatly, you know, changed. I guess my question is through some of the studies I've done, I was under the impression that a lot of the insecticides and herbicides we use on our gardens and we use out in the fields that the cows ingest and the vegetables we eat has also dropped the nutritional level of what we now call a balanced diet. Could you address that? And
I don't know if any of us have the expertise to intelligently address that. We all have the willingness to address it. The depletion of micronutrients is a major problem. Because crops are grown over and over and over, and so there is a problem with a variety of micronutrients. The most famous one is the selenium issue and whether or not we get enough selenium in our diet. The insecticide issue, the amount of insecticides that each of us eats, I was thinking of that making the sandwich, you know, with all the greens today. And the green, you know, when you have greens that don't have little holes that the insects have been eating, you know that stuff is just covered with insecticide. Otherwise, insects would have been eating little holes in those leaves. Now, how harmful is that, and is it really harmful? Obviously, we can take a lot of insecticide without obviously causing a lot of trouble, and life expectancy is increasing and all these other kinds of things, so maybe the nutritional benefits outweigh the downside, but I can't help but believe there's some downside in eating large quantities of insecticide. It just intuitively seems obvious, but it may not be true.
Well, and antibiotics and is another problem.
In meats.
Yeah.
There was another observation that may be a potential benefit to the world as a whole, and that one observation is that the sperm counts of males have been going down and down. And, of course, that results in a lower population birth rate. And it's been postulated, and there's some evidence that it may be due to the increasing exposure of toxic substances for ingesting every day. So I'm sure that's a big problem.
You can debate whether that's good or bad. Well, mainly, I just want to finish up a little bit, and then we'll open it up for some discussion. Just kind of remaking some points about what you should look for if you're going to use an herbal supplement. A lot of this is going to be repeat, but I really think it's important that if you go out there and you shop for herbal supplements or herbal medicines, that you look at certain things and remember certain things. Most importantly, always remember that there is no guarantee of what's in that herbal supplement or herbal medicine. That the potency may not be what you think it's going to be, that the ingredients in there may not be what you think it's going to be. And as far, you know, I don't shop for enough of these to know what are reliable companies. But there are mainstream, more mainstream companies. And some of you may be able to address that better than I could. But always keep that in mind. Also, you should also make sure that you talk to your physician or your healthcare provider first because some of these herbal medicines interact with the conventional medications, and they can interact in a very harmful way. They also may have side effects that may be harmful to your particular medical condition. So discuss it with whoever's been taking care of you as far as a healthcare provider and whoever's been prescribing you medicines prior to taking that herbal supplement. It's still very important. And also I would not recommend using herbal medicines for any serious medical conditions such as heart disease, lung diseases, kidney diseases, or if you're pregnant. It's obviously not going to work. If it comes up, I would not use herbal supplements if at all possible in pregnancy. So those are kind of some of the other points. And you may have some other points too as far as shopping for herbal medicines or other points about this topic before we open it up for discussion. So go ahead if you guys have some more points on this.
I would just add that there's some favorable aspects to this question. This may not be quite the big problem we assume it is from a certain perspective. Fortunately, most of the remedies that people take, and they've been taking them for thousands of years in some situations, are probably relatively harmless compared to some other things that we could buy as prescription drugs. And they're also used by fairly healthy people for very minor complaints, such as fatigue or backache or something of that sort. But I think that there's really something that bothers me about this whole question about the regulation of herbal medicines and dietary supplements. In my mind, there is absolutely no excuse for the protection of the public, and that's one of the roles of government, to provide public's health and safety, that these things are not regulated. And I lay it to the door of of the problem that we have with Congress. These laws are made in Congress, and they currently have blocked several attempts to make some kind of regulation over these drugs, which in many cases are useful, so they would not be hazardous to us. And so we would know what we're taking. But you can lay this to the door of the lack of campaign finance reform, because it's big money from manufacturers that are influencing and blocking Congress from doing reasonable control of drugs such as we have with the FDA currently exercises over our prescription drugs and over-the-counter drugs. I think that Peter has mentioned a number of drugs which are quite useful. I would just like to mention one drug that I know some people, maybe one person in this room uses and finds it very useful, and that's glucosamine for arthritis and pain. And I had several people come up to me here and tell me about it. But I think the ultimate test that I really kind of like is one of my friends also has a donkey by the name of Bernice. And she was having difficulty getting up. She was getting a little bit older, a little limping. And so he gave her some glucosamine. And she's prancing around the yard with her little daughter called Lily Bell. But what this tells us is that oftentimes we get clues that something may work. But we do need to have good studies to prove that it's efficacious in certain dosage levels. Currently, when you buy both glucosamine, we don't know whether we're getting the right dose, the maximum dose, or insufficient dose, and whether there are probably ingredients in there that could be harmful to you on the long range. So I think that we really need control of these medications so that you can take advantage of them, because I think it's really hazardous to go to a drugstore and buy these blind. If you want to buy St. John's wort for depression, you don't know what you're getting for sure in terms of the dosage.
And David, could you comment on what the situation is in Europe, or maybe somebody, I know we have at least one Canadian here with us, about whether these are controlled in a different fashion in different countries?
Well, in Germany, as a good example, the government health agency, the department of what would be compared to our FDA, has investigated herbal medications particularly, and they reviewed over a period of about 10 years something like 352 herbal remedies and accepted something like 254 as appropriate for use. And they put out a large publication called Commission E, what do they call it?
It's on your bibliography. It's Commission E Monographs.
Monographs. And in there they reviewed the scientific evidence that they were safe, that the medication or the herbal remedy was safe. They provide evidence for what the dosage should be. And all in Germany, most herbal remedies are treated like either our prescription drugs or over-the-counter drugs, and they have to be meet the standards of manufacture for purity. They have to be closely regulated for how much it contains. And I think that makes a much better situation. That really is about the only solid information for many herbal remedies that we use today. It comes from Germany. Do you have any further
comments? Joe, do you have any comments about how the regulation of this occurs in Canada, or do you know?
It's just a general impression, but and I think my memory is not very good, but a dim memory, that in Canada you cannot advertise something as a medicine, then it falls under the government authority. So you cannot say, this will do this, this will do that. They're always very, very careful to say, not to promise, not to. But of course, the stuff comes up from the States, and then the myth comes along with it. I don't know how much good it does, but in the sense of the laws, I think, are much stricter in terms of being able, what you can say a substance does, that it can't be a cure.
Yeah, to a certain extent that's true in the States too, is that most of these are sold as dietary supplements as opposed to medications. And that way they get around any...
Although you look at the public, marketing...
Oh, that's right. The marketing is something very different. It may not say it on the box that where you buy the pill, but the little pamphlet that's sitting over in the counter, which is in the health food stores, which is paid for and produced by the company that made the medicine, tells you all kinds of other things.
That can't be done in Canada. Those pamphlets get taken off the shelf.
Yeah, okay.
But they're allowed to use certain language, like say, this will improve prostate health, it'll improve your sexual activity, or it'll improve memory health. It doesn't say it cures Alzheimer's disease, but it says it improves your memory.
Usually in Canada it says may improve your memory. Possibly. A lot of adverbs and conditional clauses. But in the end, I don't think there's anything.
One of the things that should be obvious from the discussion today, and probably from your own experience, is how what starts out as an alternative drug or medication does get, if it's proved, if the scientific data are available, does get picked up by mainstream medicine and starts to be used. And I can only speak from my own experience, I can speak for my own experience, I speak for other people's experience too, but on occasion get accused of that. Within my own family, my wife started, about 3 or 4 years ago, started using chondroitin sulfate for tennis elbow and aches and pains and things like this, and I thought she was an embarrassment to me because, you know, what if the story gets around the community that my wife is using one of these things that I would not use? Well, as time has gone on, over the years, there have been some studies that Peter's has mentioned that have shown some benefit, and my patients have come back to me in great numbers and have told me how much better they have felt and functioned and have had fewer side effects using chondroitin sulfate glucosamine for a variety of arthritic kinds of problems, so that I am now recommending almost as a first-line medication the use of this. And I suspect that this will be is just one example of how these medicines or how these substances do get incorporated into practice and become kind of standard practice.
I'd like to ask you a question, Cliff. When you...
And I don't take care of donkeys.
advise a patient to take glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate, do you give them any instructions where to buy it? Because it makes a difference.
Well, I started out by being very circumspect by saying it's okay if you use it. and then pretty soon you say to take it. No, I don't, because I don't know where good and this part of the problem. I don't know which company is a reliable company and that they can get it. And I tell them to go to the local pharmacy, which, you know, and in our town there are several, and go ahead and buy it off the shelf and assume that it's going to be okay, but it might not be.
You'll buy the cheapest one, and that may be the most unreliable.
Yeah, maybe.
Have you seen the mountain of those pills in Costco?
Yeah, Kirkwood Brand, I think.
Didn't I understand that glucosamine at first was used on racehorses, and that's where they got this thing going?
Yeah, that's right. A lot. You'll see a lot of medicines that are used in veterinary medicine that people pick up. What was that? I'm slipping my mind now. The solvent that
DMSO
was one that was used, well, still used in veterinary medicine, and people will sometimes use it. The thing that I found very dangerous about DMSO is that it is essentially an industrial solvent that penetrates your skin, and of course, if it penetrates your skin, it carries anything that's in it with it. So it's like getting an injection of something. And as far as I know, there were no conclusive studies in humans that showed any benefit healing. I don't know if you guys have any more background on that, but there was a number of people who made quite a bit of money off of that.
I have a question. Millions, probably, of Americans cross the border into Mexico and buy drugs. And just the example, Premarin, and the manufacturer that manufactures it here also has the box down there. Do you have any ideas on that?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And people from the Northwest who winter in down in Arizona, that's one of the benefits of wintering in Arizona, Southern California, is that you go down with your prescriptions and you get your year supply or 6 month supply of medicine over the border. I think several important issues. First of all, many of the medicines, if not the majority, are the exact same medicines made by the exact same companies, sold at a fraction of the cost. And this is typical. This is typical of Merck, Pfizer, SmithKline, Beecham, and all the big companies, that they, for a pill that they will charge $2 in the United States, they can sell in Mexico or throughout Latin America or Africa or Southeast Asia for a fraction of the price and still make a profit. Which is kind of phenomenal when you think about that. They know that if they sold it at $2 a pill, and the majority of Mexicans could never afford to buy it, so that it's sold at so they just set it at a price that the market would bear. So you can get the same preparation. Having said that, there are large numbers of counterfeit medicines that are down there that look exactly alike, that are made by fly-by-night companies that You know, it's very easy to reproduce a box that says Premarin on it with the same thing and sealed, and it looks exactly the same thing. And the pill can be, look exactly the same, and it may have, it may be nothing but sugar water, sugar pill
or,
in it.
Or worse, have some
have something kind of worse. Yeah. And so there is a potential unknown, and you just hope that the pharmacy you go to in Tijuana or over the border is going to be reliable and has been getting its medications and its supplies from a reputable supply house. The third thing is people who go, people who have had arthritis or whatever and go down to Mexico and see a practitioner there and get a local prescription. Many, many, and arthritis is something I am familiar with, and I am familiar with pills that are given out for pulmonary problems that contain cortisone.
Yeah.
Contain cortisone in relatively high concentration. Now, cortisone is a wonderful drug, has saved lots of lives, but it has a horrendous number of side effects if you take it over the long term. And if you don't know you're taking it, it can be really hazardous. And that is a very dangerous problem. And we've seen people come back having been taking cortisone and saying, gee, my lungs are doing much better. And they look, they're all bloated and they've got these big black and blue spots all over them. And they've developed diabetes and hypertension and cataracts and ulcers and osteoporosis and all the problems that go with cortisone. So I think those are the caveats.
Would you address antioxidants such as vitamin E and I know my sister takes some witch's brew of OPC, which is supposed to be antioxidant, and there's just all of these, well, I call them witch's brew, of antioxidant formulas, and...
I have a witch's brew that I prescribe for virtually all my patients, and I take myself.
He made me take it.
Over the years, there's been increasing evidence. Again, much of this derives from, is it better to take antioxidants
or
by eating foods that naturally contain antioxidants, or is it better to take it in tablet form? It's hard to get people to really eat well-balanced diets, to really get their five or six vegetables. In fact, the study of Oregonians, and I suspect Oregonians and Washingtonians are fairly similar, demonstrated that when you looked at health issues, Oregonians over the age of 65, only 11% smoke. Well, that's pretty good. But 65% don't eat five vegetables a day, vegetables and fruits a day. So, that's just sort of an example of a health habit that we would like people to, or we think is important, and they don't do it. To get back to the witch's brew, I think what I tell my patients, and there's not really good scientific evidence. There's bits and pieces of scientific evidence, but I think it's harmless, and I think it's helpful, and I think it may be of some benefit. Vitamin C. There's pretty good evidence. There's excellent evidence that human beings, guinea pigs, and primates are the only organisms, the only living organisms on the face of this planet that don't make their own vitamin C. We are vitamin C obligate. We have to eat vitamin C. If you were a guinea pig, you don't have to eat any vitamin C, and if you were a monkey, you don't have... I'm sorry, that's just the opposite. If you're a guinea pig or a monkey or a human, you have to eat vitamin C. Now, don't ask me why... The good Lord designed us that way, but that's the way we are. We're deficient in those enzymes. Linus Pauling thinks we should eat 12 grams, or did think before he died, that we should eat 12 grams of vitamin C per day, which is a huge amount. It's like 24 tablets of the 500 milligram tablets. That was based on extrapolating the size of a guinea pig to the size of a man. And he was a Nobel laureate.
Yeah, twice over.
But we probably need more. In fact, I think the FDA just increased what they from 30 milligrams
not
to
more
60
than,
milligrams.
Not more than he's talking about.
That's right. And so I recommend 500 milligrams a day. As sort of a compromise. I don't know what the right number is, but 500 milligrams is one good-sized tablet. I recommend vitamin E, another antioxidant, which is which has, you I don't know whether you mentioned vitamin E, but vitamin E does have, has shown some, in a variety of studies, shown some benefit in terms of delaying the progression of Alzheimer's disease. There is some evidence that it does lower the incidence of some cancers and perhaps of coronary disease. So it's a useful thing. So and 400 unit, there seems to be a benefit at between 200 and 600, and above 800, there may be a negative effect. So I generally have recommended 400 milligrams, 400 international units of vitamin E. So part of it, 500 of C, 400 international units of vitamin E. And I recommend an aspirin a day if there's no contraindication.
That's very clear.
To that. For, we're talking about adults. We're talking about people probably over the age of 50. And there's a lot of data that demonstrate that taking a low dose of aspirin.
Is that a baby aspirin?
I'm sorry?
Is that a baby aspirin?
At least 81 milligrams a day, which would be with the equivalent of a baby aspirin. You can take more than that, but that, it seems it takes that much to produce its effect on the platelets, and does lower the risk of stroke, and it lowers the risk of heart attack. And therefore,
and may be effective in other things.
So that's my little commission. So Dave just said, what about selenium? And I mentioned that before. The Linus Pauling Institute at Oregon State University recommends selenium as well, 200 milligrams per day, or micrograms.
Micrograms
per day.
What are the vegetables that are highest in selenium?
Good question. Can anyone help us here with that?
Well, it depends on where the vegetables are grown.
Yeah, because they pick it up from the soil.
Well, but if they're grown in a...
If they're going, well, if they're grown in Oregon,
that's right. If they're grown near,
because of the rain, the soil is leached of its selenium, so that the vegetables are deficient in selenium.
I'm under the impression that they're root vegetables, things like turnips and parsnips and things like that, but I'm not sure.
Source: mushrooms, whole grains, eggs, garlic, lean meats, and seafood. Mushrooms, whole grains, eggs, garlic.
What is that?
Lean meats and seafood.
If you translated your three things into foods, how much orange juice would it take to get your 500 milligrams, and what would it take to get your vitamin E?
Do you have that in your book?
No, I
didn't.
I don't think it'd take that much.
But what's the new standard for vitamin C?
They went from 30 to 60 or something.
Two glasses of orange juice would be equivalent to the 60.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you'd be.
But that's just enough to prevent scurvy. It's like a lime a day.
There was a time when doctors discouraged you, said it wasn't necessary to take a vitamin capsule. Now I understand that more and more physicians are saying, good, thank you.
Absolutely, and I should mention on that question about the witch's brew, and I didn't say, a good multivitamin in addition to the vitamin C, vitamin E, and aspirin. And the most important part of that good multivitamin is folic acid, which was mentioned here earlier in terms of preventing neural tube defects in pregnant women. But there's a condition called homocysteinemia, which probably affects 10 or 15% or more of the population, which it is an elevated level of this particular type of amino acid in the bloodstream, and it predisposes to coronary artery disease.
And now they're showing that it's predisposing to other conditions.
And so you can go and get a test to find out if you have that. And the treatment for that is one multivitamin tablet a day. So why go through the problem of testing for it and trying to figure out if you have it when you can cure it prevent it and take care of it just by taking this 400 micrograms a day or 0.4 milligrams per day of folic acid, and every multivitamin contains that.
I think it's important to mention also that some people, you'll hear people recommend mega doses of vitamins. Now, with some vitamins, that's not a problem because they're water soluble. That means they dissolve in water, which means you can get rid of them pretty easily from your body. Other ones like A, D, E, and K, all those are fat soluble, which means they'll build up in your body. And if you take large doses of those, it can be very harmful and toxic. So when you're talking about vitamin C and make in large doses, that's probably not going to be something that hurts you because you'll just get rid of the excess in your urine. Some of these other ones you don't get rid of so easily, like A and D. So you have to watch some of those recommendations when people talk about having large
doses. In fact, there is a condition. Polar bear and seal livers are very high in concentration of vitamin A. And in the Eskimo group, when they didn't understand and no one had told them about how much trouble they could get into by eating large quantities of polar bear liver, they could get a condition called cerebral edema from this elevated vitamin A in the bloodstream, and many people died.
Some of the early Arctic explorers, yeah.
Question? Could you talk a little bit about the use of calcium and the different sources of calcium?
Calcium is important, especially postmenopausal women, in preventing osteoporosis. It can also be important in premenopausal women who are lactose intolerant and need calcium to supplement their diet. Most of the calcium, there's all kinds of formulations out there. And we've just discussed this in the community with some of the members of the community. The most common formulation is calcium carbonate. That's essentially what's in Tums. And as far as I know, that's just fine for supplementation. I don't know what you're recommending.
That's exactly what I recommend. I recommend two Tums tablets a day for everybody.
Now, vitamin D is the vitamin that's used by the body to help you absorb that calcium and put it into bone. And vitamin D often is made by your skin through sunlight, but often we will supplement that in postmenopausal women. But again, a multivitamin probably provides you with vitamin D to do that. I don't know if you're adding that. Some people will recommend
that. I think you're going to spend the winter in Holden Village where the sun doesn't get down here to the valley
right,
floor.
Right, behind Bucks
Camp. You absolutely should be taking some vitamin D.
Yeah. But yeah, there's no reason to spend a lot of money on calcium, really expensive calcium supplements, when you can get it from simple sources like Tums.
Like Tums.
Yeah.
So what you're recommending is we take a good multivitamin, two Tums, one aspirin, one vitamin D, and one C every day.
And that's if you don't have any illness at all.
I mean, you're rattling like...
Yeah, you know, it's really...
Isn't there one thing that has all this?
No. It would be this
big.
You couldn't swallow it. You'd have to... you know,
really?
As long as you eat the diet at Holden Village, you're fine.
You know, you're absolutely right, and it's a little... I find it kind of embarrassing that because I didn't grow up... And I wasn't trained to prescribe all these or recommend these things. And yet, it seems that it makes a lot of sense. And you can either do it on your own, or you can go ahead and have your physician bless it and say that it's okay to do it, or you don't have to do it. You're not going to die if you don't do it, but it may be of some benefit.
Sometimes I almost wonder if the stress it causes and getting all those things together and taking them every day doesn't cause problems.
But we have an answer to your question about taking so many pills.
Yeah.
Well, I guess if you have to, you have to. But what is them about? We have a friend that's pushing something called Juice Plus.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like there's another thing that that's in a capsule that looks like ground up alfalfa, and it's supposed to give you more energy and help you lose weight. past a level where it helps break down the fat. I don't know. She didn't give me the name of it. She's just telling me.
You probably never know what's in there.
Well, that's why I sent her one of the side effects. She said, oh, there are none. So that's one thing I'm going to carry around.
Drinking too much water causes side effects.
But Juice Plus is something. I mean, you get a tape. This friend sent us a tape and all this hoo-ha about it. And it's something you add to juice or you take the pill, whichever you want to do. And it's supposed to just give you more energy, and you got all these vitamins and all this other
stuff. It's supposed to be a concentrate of, I don't know, 7-Eleven different vegetables that have been boiled down to a...
Yeah. VH juice has that too, so...
VH juice.
Yeah. As a physician, I came here, didn't know if I was going to learn anything today. The condition that we're speaking about, certainly has serious implications, but I never heard a pregnancy called a serious disease.
It can be.
Well, if you were just a minute, I think one of the things that we really need to do, and as our age group really need to make sure that we demonstrate to our children and our grandchildren, is that good food is a very important thing for our bodies, and you're not going to cure the world with pills. That's why I asked how much food does it take to get the E and the A and these things. And I think the more we do that, it takes a little more effort, but I think it's important.
I think that's an excellent point.
And hopefully physicians and other healthcare providers in the future are going to be getting better training in nutrition. A lot of schools are providing nutrition courses where, at least in my medical school, was nearly non-existent.
But nurses get it.
Yeah, okay.
I'd like to share something with you. This is 100 years ago, and it's here. You know, here are three physicians are trying to tell people who've already been very successful in surviving. None of us died in infancy or early childhood, or and we've made it here. But what it is? It's about longevity of physicians. So for physicians to be telling other people how to live, because I'll just read it for you. In the official registration report of Massachusetts for 1843 to 1866, the average age of physicians who died was 55 at that time. Well, that sounds pretty good. Except that the average age of lawyers was 56. Clergy were 58, and judges were 66. This is back in the 1840s. Now, this was written, that's kind of amazing. It said few physicians survive to extreme old age, but as a class, they enjoy comparatively long career despite the risk of contagious diseases, etc. In 1796, a fellow by the name of Hufflin writing an article called "The Art of Prolonging Life." I guess that's what we're kind of doing today. It says, physicians who so abundantly dispense to others the means of health and life, this is so great that this was written 200 years ago, ought to claim a distinguished place. But unfortunately, this is not the case. It may be said of them in general, in serving others, they are consumed. In healing others, they are destroyed. And then they conclude with some advice. They did another study, and again, showing that that physicians died younger than theologians who lived quite long, and farmers who lived longer, commercial men lived longer, physicians, professors lived longer, physicians died the earliest. Many of the physicians died of suicide, by the way. This was written in 1892, advice to physicians, so maybe it would apply to all of us here as well as physicians. It said, the lesson then is, what we should learn from our deceased colleagues is not to work too long. When you find your arterial tension increasing, your temporal artery becoming tortuous, your radial growing hard, especially if you have a little palpitation and past increased amount of limpid urine, not quite sure what limpid urine is, but I assume on most of us men here, that's what we pass.
whatever your years, know that old age is upon you. Henceforth, shape your life like one who is old. Curb your ambition. Be content with a small practice. Reduce your expenses. Give up your night work. Decline confinements. Take a long vacation in summer. Retire early. Eat abstemiously. Drink not at all. Sell your horse.
Good one.
It gets rid of your car, I guess. Take a great deal of moderate exercise in open air. Watch the functions of the skin. Guard against the chill. Cultivate an even disposition. And study to be quiet. And maybe we could add to that, spend a week at home. But you know, sometimes it may be a little presumptuous of us as physicians to be giving advice on how to live long. However, there was an accompanying study to that particular article that was written in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1896. In 100 years later, a study was done, and physicians were in 1996 lived just as long as the general population. There was no difference in the and I think probably what many physicians died from in the earlier days, especially in the 1800s, was tuberculosis, because of the exposure to that, and that was just part of the an occupational hazard.
Now doctors take Wednesday off for golf, and that's why they're living longer.
Not many of us play golf.
Well, I would like to go back to the vitamin business again. We have the minimum standards that are promoted in there. They've increased them some, like for for vitamin C, it's increased in some. But from all the studies that I know, indicates that people our age don't eat well enough, don't eat a balanced diet. And we always talk about the younger generation eating junk food. Well, we're in that same category sometimes, but we don't eat the right things.
Or not.
And so I think that you either have a choice of either eating, following a good dietitian's directions, and that's where you should get your advice, I think, rather from a malinformed physician. And I think what you should do is to eat, if you aren't capable of following a good, balanced diet, I think Cliff's recommendation is very important, that you should take a balanced multivitamin. And I think that there are many hazards in following the advice of people who advise macro vitamin therapy, because there are a lot of side effects for those, and there is no evidence that the macro dose benefits you.
Yeah, one of the question that was asked, how much orange juice do you have to drink, and how much food do you have to eat? It's if you eat a well-balanced diet and you eat around 2,000 to 2,500 calories a day, and I suspect Peter running up and down the mountains here eats 3,000, 4,000 calories a day or so, and burns that up, he's going to get the vitamins. He's going to get what he needs. If you live a much more sedentary life, where you're really eating 1,200, 1,000, 1,200, 1,400 calories a day, it's going to be much more difficult, even if it's well balanced, to get the nutrients that are needed. And I think that's, and so I'm not recommending for a 25-year-old to take a handful of pills. My practice, it consists of older folks who don't eat a lot. Many live by themselves, don't like to cook, just don't shop very well, and really don't have well-balanced diets. Now, you like to encourage them to do that, but that's sometimes hard and unrealistic to think they're going to achieve that. So it becomes easier to take a few pills. Plus, it's also consistent with the American way of looking at it.
I was wondering how much frolic acid.
Oh, folic acid? I think it's 1 milligram.
Well, one milligram is more than enough. Is well over enough. What you need is 400 micrograms, or 0.4 milligrams, which is the standard amount, which is in, if you look at Centrum and One a Day and Unicap, and that's what's in every one of them.
What about osteoporosis? My doctor told me to take 400 to 800 mil of vitamin D. Mm-hmm. Is that too much?
I don't think so.
No, that's fine.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah. Any other questions on?
What are the contraindications for taking aspirin, one aspirin a day? You said unless there are contraindications, what would they be?
Allergy.
Yeah, you could be allergic to it.
Allergy to aspirin. There's a number of different kinds of allergies, but a more common one is that you break out in a terrible rash with it. There's another one that's associated with people with asthma. There's a number of people who have asthma. Not everyone with asthma has trouble with aspirin, but maybe 10% of asthmatics, and especially those who have polyps in the nose, what's called nasal polyposis, the combination of asthma, nasal polyps, and they have a sensitivity to aspirin, and the asthma gets a whole lot worse. People who have had active bleeding problems may not be able to take aspirin if they have bleeding ulcers and things of that sort, or if they've had a hemorrhage, or if they have what's called a low platelet count. So there are a number of things. It's probably wise if you haven't had a chance to discuss it with your physician before you start taking the aspirin, is just to make sure that there isn't a problem or that it won't be an interaction with another drug. There's a drug called Coumadin, which is a blood thinner, and some physicians don't want to have patients take both, although it certainly is reasonably safe to take both. But that should be run by your...
It needs to be followed, yeah, if you do take both. Anybody else have any other questions?
Do we have a few more minutes here?
Yeah.
I'd like to pose a question as it just relates to alternative medicine, something that, and this sort of covers today as well as yesterday, when we dealt with chiropractic and acupuncture and a whole variety of things, some of which seem to help and some which don't seem to have much direct benefit, and that is, should health insurance or Medicare pay for those services? Mm-hmm. And I'm just kind of curious what the sense of individuals are here, whether if someone wants reflexology to have, you know, somebody massage the foot or figure out some ways it's supposed to work things, should this be covered?
And this is a real issue because it's being debated in many states as to whether their insurance programs cover that as a basic package.
Well, aren't they covering some of it, like a naturopathic doctor? Aren't they covered now?
State of Washington, they are.
Yeah, depends on which state you're in and what you're talking about.
They're not covered in Oregon.
There will be an initiative proposed in the state of Oregon to cover insurance coverage and payment in a universal health care program to cover all licensed practitioners, whether they're naturopaths, whether they're homeopathic physicians, or whether they're whatever. And this greedy, my own feeling is that you really have so many health dollars. And I think you eventually come to the place where you almost have to do what Oregon has done to a certain extent, and that is, you might call it rationing, but it's spending your money where it's most effective. Mm-hmm. And I think that Oregon has experimented with this, and it's being proposed, so if we're going to include all the other practitioners, we have to be sure that their treatments are cost-effective and safe, and that the outcomes are good. Because otherwise, we're going to be channeling money from very effective use, such as treatment of newborns or whatever.
Prenatal care.
And diverting it to something that is not even proven.
And I'm not a big defender of insurance companies, but do realize that when you mandate that they include something in their plan, that raises premiums. It's going to be a cost to everybody. So, you know, it does come back to haunt you. If that's something you feel you want to pay for, then that's a different matter. Just do realize you'll pay for it.
I think we're opening a Pandora's box when we say go for all of that.
Yeah.
Oh, I do too.
I think Dr. Hall asked the question. I'd like to ask him, have him answer it.
Yeah. Oh, you answered it for me, David. I think you answered it very well. But I was having a chat with Joe Gallagher coming down the mountain today and about healthcare, and it seems to me rather ludicrous that we would provide coverage for things that have not been established when something to the tune of 15% of our population has no coverage for anything. That we have children in this country that get acute appendicitis or break their leg or their arm or something and may have no health insurance whatsoever, so that their families get hit with big bills that can be financially devastating. And that happens at a time when people who have good and broad coverage, and that's by and large the only group that really does, are those of us sitting here that are in the Medicare age group, which have universal coverage, who are asking for more and more coverage for things that have less and less utility and want it covered, want it paid for, when there's 15% of our fellow citizens in this country have no coverage whatsoever.
In Canada, we were talking, basically, if the service isn't provided by an MD, in most cases, it's not covered by the health plan. It varies from province to province.
They have a very basic
chiropractors and that sort of thing, but just basically. So if you're a naturopath and you're an MD, then...
You move to the States.
Yeah.
Do you think that we will ever be under socialized medicine?
I always kind of cringe a little bit when people say it, because it has such negative connotations. I'm an unabashed socialist, so I'll tell you that right up front. I hope that we someday will cover all our people. I think that that's something that we have to do. Whether we'll do it in a fashion that's, you know, not chaotic and cost effective, I have doubts about that. I happen to be a supporter of a system like Canada's. A single payer system. Now, there's ways to modify that to make it more palatable to people in the United States from their kind of point of view of individualism. This is a whole another, you know, couple of days of talks, but I have doubts about whether we're going to do that in the near future.
How many people are covered by Medicare in here? Medicare or Medicare HMO or Medicare, whatever, it's the great majority. All of you are under socialized medicine.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Now, we first of all have to define socialized medicine. Because
the government is taking care of it.
Hired by the government.
Yeah. It's regulated.
It's a single payer system.
Okay.
And understand that Medicare, when we talk about overhead, we're talking about what they pay out in administrative, what it costs to run the program. Its overhead's about 4%, whereas you look at your average private health insurance, the overhead there is in the order of 15 to 20%. So that's some of the costs that you're going to save. And I'm getting into my soapbox, but that's what you're going to be saving by going to something like that. And then we have the opportunity to cover everybody, too, with that extra savings.
Well, I think it's difficult for some of us who do use alternative medicines now, which what we can do with our insurance companies is raise our deductible. Okay. So I pay out less now in my form of medical than I would have for premiums, because I can raise the deductible really high.
if I have been using a form of medicine and a form of, and a belief system that works for me, where do I fall when I get to be Medicare age? I can't, you know.
Of course, Medicare doesn't cover prescription drugs. As it stands now,
but,
for a lot of people,
would,
but yeah, for
it wouldn't cover
you're talking about someone just going and seeing people,
yeah.
Yeah.